Do you think so?
40 years ago, your FBI was founded hunting down John Dillinger. Now, we have extreme violence between strangers.
We travel around the country and teach FBI techniques to cops.
You guys mind if I bother you for a minute?
She was found cuffed and lashed to the bed.
What people won't do to each other. There's nothing people won't do.
How can we help?
Psychopaths are convinced that there's nothing wrong with them, so these men are virtually impossible to study. Yet you have found a way in near-perfect laboratory conditions.
Hello, ladies.
That's what makes this so exciting and potentially so far-reaching.
We all love that show, The Mindhunters. Finally, we have our guest on. So putting together a crime scene, who is the perpetrator? This is something that we think about all the time now. But back in the 70s, this was not something that the FBI did. Ann Wolbert Burgess was one of the FBI agents who was on the ground floor of criminal profiling back in the 1970s. She has a new book, Killer by Design, Murders, Mindhunters, and My Quest to Decipher the Criminal Mind. Welcome to the show, Ann. How are you?
Fine. Thank you very much, Karen.
So for those who don't know the history, can you tell our listeners briefly about the FBI's creation of this behavioral science unit, referred to by some in the Mindhunters?
Right. It started really back around the mid-1950s when Howard Teton and Agent Mulcavey had these informal meetings with the agents after their classes were over, and they'd sit around and talk about cases as they were coming in where they needed to find out who the suspect was. And this later developed. The one person who was the student was Robert Ressler. And Bob Ressler really got interested in this, and he was teaching criminal psychology, and he figured he better go out and talk to some criminals so that he could teach the course better. And so he was going out on weekends when he was on what they call these road schools and talking with them. At the same time, William Webster, who is now the new director of the FBI, said that the training division, the FBI Academy, should actually be doing their own research. So he very much said that the instructors, who were the special agents at the Academy, could start their own research. And so this is where Bob Ressler now was able to kind of turn his rogue kind of interviewing of criminals into something specific. And he took a partner, John Douglas, who was new to the unit. And because I was down there lecturing on rape victimology and had worked with Roy Hazelwood to do some of his research, John and Bob came to me and said, would you be interested in what our project was? And so I listened to some of the interviews that he was having and said, I really felt he had something there. And if you have watched Mindhunter, I know you played some of it earlier, that the third episode is when they come up to my school in Boston and we talk about it. And it was just very, very impressive. So that's really how it started, that I said we had to tighten up or develop a methodology. So I became the methodologist in this. My background as a researcher, I was able to, of course, draw on those factors. So we designed a study, and that's how it all started, to look at the profiling, to look at the first look at characteristics of serial killers so that we could better define some of these profiling characteristics.
Now, a lot of the stuff that the data that you get were sourced from some of the interviews that were done with some of the serial killers. And my question is always, and anyone who listens to my show knows, I represented a high profile, or I say low profile, serial killer here in Chicago many, many years ago. And so I kind of understand a little bit about the mind of the sociopath. And they're very manipulative and they're very deceptive and they're not really, you can't really rely on them to tell you the truth. They almost always say what you think, you know, they want you, that you expect to hear. So how do you rely on someone who's sitting in jail who you knew has done horrible things and you know they're a sociopath and you know that they might be lying to you?
Well, sure. But I think the agents had a very special or more unique role here because they commanded a lot of authority. I mean, just going into the prisons and talking with them gave the criminal that they were interviewing, the serial killer, kind of a status, if you will, that they were coming to talk to them. So it really played into the killer's ego. The agents also, we got all the records, helped them with all the background records. So they knew the case cold when they went in, so that if anything deviated from what they had read in the record, they'd call them on it. So that very quickly, I think, as well as I understood how the interviews were going and as I read them, that they got as close to a true report as possible. For example, David Berkowitz, he started that dog. He had something about a dog, and I remember
this is Son of John, Sam. Excuse me, Son of Sam. Yes,
thank you. Yeah, Son of Sam. And they essentially said, we don't believe you. You know, this is not so. There's no dog talking to you. And he smiled at that point and realized that they had really caught him. And they felt that after that they were able to get more important information. So they would do that. They would know whether it was wonderful to have the background records so that we could rely on them as we then compared them to the content that they were telling the agents. And because we were using a standard questionnaire, we were able to see if they were kind of outliers, if you will, you know, were some of them really going off track. And if there was any question that they were, that it was not true, we would take the records report for it.
So, you know, some of the little anecdotes in your book are just amazing. There was one, and I forgot exactly who the killer was, but the agents were saying, well, this person has probably got like a, you know, a three-piece suit buttoned really tight, maybe a speech impediment. Maybe this person is going to call the family on the anniversary of the crime. And in that case, like all three of those things were true. So how does... I mean, that sounds like psychic stuff. That sounds like, you know, that sounds like voodoo. How do you reach those types of conclusions that those things might happen in a case from looking at the crime scene and looking at the victims?
Because they're looking at the behavior and because they are looking at the personality background. And one of the cases, one of the examples that John Douglas gives in his Mindhunter book is on David Carpenter. Now, David Carpenter was out in the Los Angeles area, I think Santa Cruz, at a time in the early 80s when there are Kemper was there, Mullen, a series of killers. So he profiled, this was, David Carpenter was the trailside killer. He would go to these parks, and if there was a lone female, that's the way he would get her. And as John said, he would, he figured out from the crime scene that he would approach the victim from the back, and he would immediately control her some way. And what, it was a blitz style attack. And he said he figured that this was someone that's asocial, not antisocial, asocial, more withdrawn, shy, not able to engage in any kind of conversation. And so one of the things that he said, he got just about everything right. He said it was going to be a white male. He felt it'd be early 30s. He said that he would race was the same, white on white, which is pretty standard. But the thing he said at the end to this group of law enforcement is that he would have a speech impediment. And like you said, you know, is this voodoo? And he said he sure hoped he was going to be right because he didn't know. But he felt that there was something in this man because of his behavior in the crime scene that spoke to his being very, not ashamed, but very sensitive to some kind of defect. He wasn't sure what type of defect, but he felt it was a speech impediment. And when they ever found David Carpenter, indeed, he had a very bad stuttering. And the other thing, there was one witness that survived, and he said he had very crooked yellow teeth. So those were all things specific to his mouth, if you will, and to his talking. Now, what happened in court when they arraigned him is it took him minutes to even be able to say yes. I mean, he stammered and stuttered, and so it really came out when he was very, very anxious. One of the things that they found out, though, is that when he was in control of a victim, he could give these very static kind of, you know, do this, do that, not in any conversational way, but he had enough control when he was in control not to stutter.
Oh, my gosh. So that's really fascinating. Really fascinating.
Yeah, I thought it was, too. Yeah.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about coming onto the crime scene. What are the important things you look at? I want to talk about the difference between organized and disorganized crimes. I also want to talk a little bit about what it was like being the only female back in that time to be on this very interesting, in this interesting group of people. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN.
That was 1 week before I murdered my mother. I said, she's got to die, and I've got to die. More girls like that are going to die. And that's when I decided I'm going to murder my mother. I knew a week before she died I was going to kill her. And she went out to a party. She got soused. She came home, went to sleep. I was woken up by that. I came out. I walked up to her bed. She's laying there reading a paperback. As many thousands of nights before. I cut off her head, and I humiliated her corpse. So there, you know, a six young woman dead because of the way she raises her son, and the way her son is raised, the way he grows up. And what's her closing words? I suppose you want to sit up all night and talk.
Does that sound familiar, Ann?
It sure does. That's Ed Kemper.
That's Ed Kemper. And if you watch Mindhunters, he's this very, very, very tall and large, I don't know, he's 6'9 or 6'8, actor who portrays Ed Kemper perfectly. He looks like him. He sounds like him. And this is a guy who's had done some very, very horrible, awful things and was in the process there of blaming his mother.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about the crime scene itself. So you have said, and one of the interesting parts of this is that you come from the victimology standpoint. So you come from this situation of dealing with victims of rape. And so the focus has been on the perpetrators, but you're focusing on the victims. So I first want to talk about the crime scene. What are the things that the profilers are looking for? And then I'm going to also ask you about what the victims, the choice of victims, says about the perpetrator.
Sure. Well, the organized disorganized is the first concept, if you will, or the first way when the agents go to a crime scene that they're going to kind of decide which way it is, and that gives them a starting point, and that's why it's so important. I know there's been a lot of criticism of it and so forth, but it works for them, and it really helps them. And organizes where there are very few clues. They're going to have to work pretty hard. They probably have a pretty sophisticated killer or someone that knows how to avoid police. Whereas the disorganized, there are going to be a lot of clues. It's going to be a messy crime scene. There might be DNA left now that we have DNA and forensics. And it may well be that this is someone that has a mental illness. And so they're not going to have as hard a time, if you will, on catching this person because they're going to look for him. It's usually going to be a male. They're going to look for him probably in some psychiatric facility. So that is really, really important. And then the crime scene indicators are those that they try to identify, and that is what they will send back to the local police, that the local police can then look at their suspects. And those crime scene indicators are race of the victim, age of the they'll be able to see victim, because that's the only thing they have at a homicide is a victim. So they'll go after age, they'll go after race, they'll go after location, what was the killer live near that area, or did they have a vehicle that he came into the area? Should they be looking for a car? You know, that kind of thing. Also, work. What type of work? They can profile that, and that becomes important. It may be the time of day that the victim was encountered or that the victim was murdered. Might imply that the killer, such as in the John Jobert case, that he would go out very early in the morning before he went to work, and that's when he would hunt his victims. So that is important. The work situation, who they lived with, should they be looking for someone that's married or living with a parent or et cetera, that kind of thing. And that's what then the local police can take and look through their list.
And it sounds simple, but it can't possibly be simple because because even if you, I mean, it's amazing how some of the profiles would say this person was military, this person has probably a 9-to-5 job, this person probably has a wife and kids, this probably person maybe be religious. I mean, these little traits that come out in different ways are just, again, I keep thinking, is this based on science or is this an art?
I think it's actually both, and that's what I think I write about, is that we certainly use the science as best we can, and that was the purpose of analyzing the data from 36 serial killers to see if they had some common factors there, and then they could use that. But they get very good at doing this because they're doing it day after day as these cases come in. So, of course, they get good. And they have talked with so many of the criminals that helps, too. And they profiling isn't the only thing that they do using this data. They do proactive techniques in court, or they may help in setting up a polygraph. One of the cases in the book, even though the suspect had passed the polygraph, they felt that it was not an adequate polygraph, and they suggested go back and do another one, and then they gave the questions to ask. So all of those things they use, because they have seen so many of these cases. It's like a good diagnostician in a medical facility. They can tell very quickly sometimes what the diagnosis is without a whole lot of tests, because they've just seen the person over and over. Or even take the COVID situation, where able to pinpoint that even sometimes before doing the test.
So this morning, as I was getting prepared, I was getting in the mood, I was turned on a Jeffrey Dahmer interview. That's what we all do when we're getting prepared for an interview. And you know, I'm always surprised when I watch Jeffrey Dahmer talk, because he's so mild-mannered, he's so intelligent, he seems kind of pathetic. He does seem a little bit remorseful, but you know, you look at Gacy, who was not remorseful, who was arrogant, but yet Gacy had this life where he went to church and he helped his neighbors and he volunteered for things and he kept, you know, his lawn nice and he made a lot of money and he was a good husband when he was married. I mean, how do these people live this life on one hand and have this secret life on the other? Is this kind of a split of a personality? Does something overcome them, do you believe? Or do you think this is something that they just, that's part of their life, they just do it?
Well, the data that we looked at really showed early incidents had influenced, if you will, the environment or the growing up situation. There was usually something in the background in which you could pinpoint. Whether or not the person himself could recognize it or not, it certainly stuck out in our, at least in my analysis, as something. And certainly Gacy's had a lot of mocking and teasing and putting down by his father, of all
right.
people, so that a male authority person was important. So his need to be in control and to be dominant overrode his at certain points in his life that he had to act out and to get that need fulfilled. And I think that's what you see in them. The other thing I don't think people realize is, yes, the killing is certainly horrible and terrible for the victim and family, but there's the getting away with it that gives them almost another high, that they can do all of these things and still not be caught. And that's certainly Gacy was very important in that, because look at how many victims he had. And even when you look at the interviews, I've got one that Bob Ressler did. He keeps denying it, and he says, I don't know where all these victims came from. You know, I helped out some of the victim families. I didn't do it. I don't know why why they said I did it. So even in that sense that he denies any culpability for that, I think is amazing. Don't you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, at first he confessed to it all, almost unburdened himself the night that he was arrested. And, you know, he had massive details. He drew them a map of where the bodies were. And, you know, and then he came to his senses and said, I better start denying it. And to his very death bed, which was at, you know, at the prison here under the lethal injection, he still denied it. And, said he would always say the only thing I am guilty of is running a cemetery without a license, which he thought was very funny, you know, but, there's a serial killer humor. But yeah, it's, and then I guess I have to ask you this question too, is, and we only just have a few minutes, would the Gacy's of the world, would the Dahmers of the world, would they, if they were released, I know Dahmer's dead, but, and Gacy's dead, but if you took those people out of jail, would they do it again? Is there any way to stop them?
I don't think there is, and we asked that question. I can just remember John Jobert was asked that question by the lead detective after he was convicted, and they said, if we let you go, would you be okay? And he said, no, I wouldn't. I know I would kill again. And I think many of the other killers said that to us, and they also, some of them don't even go to their parole hearings because they don't want to even apply for parole. So my answer to your question is yes, that they would go out, and it's so part of them. It's such a obsession with them that they, and the high that they get from it is something they want to repeat, and they think about it over and over. That's what they told us. They can't get it out of their minds. It's like that, I think you asked, could we prevent this? Well, the Michigan shooter just a couple of months ago.
Right.
What does he say? Look what he says. I can't get the thoughts out of my mind. Help me. He even recognized he needed help. So that's what is hard to understand of how the mind processes it over and over, almost to the point where if they don't act on it, they're going to probably just collapse mentally.
On the other hand, I think it's a very stressful way to live your life. You know, I know in Gacy's case, he was working 10 hours a day. Sometimes he was killing two or three boys. I believe one night he killed three boys. You know, this takes a lot of energy. And I think he was probably in a crisis mode when he was arrested. And I bet he felt relief. And having talked to him in prison, I think he was pretty much happy there. I think he had an orderly life. He was the top dog. I mean, you don't get much worse than that. And he was, yeah.
I love his stationery. You know, he even had his own stationery when he wrote the letters. He had a lot of letters. He just carried on, but he was controlled. And I think he knew that's what was good about it, is he was controlled. These killers have to be controlled. They have to be stopped. Oop. They can't stop themselves.
Ann Burgess, thank you so much for joining us. Killer by Design, Murders, Mindhunters, and My Quest to Decipher the Criminal Mind. A great book. Please join us again soon.